The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Today we're going to take you back to the year 2003, my interview with Mark Kurlansky for his book Salt, A World History.
Hello. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Mark Kurlansky. His new book, Salt, A World History, has just come out in paperback. He joins us by telephone from New York City. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Nice to talk to you.
You know, Mark, we've had quite a bit of snow out here in Ohio, and
I've heard rumors to that effect, yeah.
Yeah. Every day when I come inside, I have this white deposit on my shoes, and it's really kind of bothering me, and then I realized that it was probably salt.
Yeah, you know, guilty. The United States is the largest salt consumer in the world, and it uses about 50% of that salt for de-icing roads. And it's just enormous amounts. I wish I had the figure on how much salt was thrown on roads last week. Mm. You know, just enormous amounts.
It's got to be close to a record.
Yeah, I mean, I happen to have been passing through St. Louis, and somebody gave me the St. Louis figure alone was 3,000 tons.
Amazing.
And they weren't hit that badly.
You know, salt is such a ubiquitous substance. I think we all kind of take it for granted. Now, I'm always appreciative of the fact that I have fresh, clean water to drink, but I never really think about the salt. And I think the salt's just about as important as the water.
Well, they're both things that the human body needs to function, although we need more water than we need salt. We need a fairly small amount of salt, which is why in history, whenever you find hunter-gatherer tribes, they aren't particularly interested in salt, because if you have an all-game diet, you have all the salt you need.
It comes out of the game.
Yeah, meat is full of salt because mammals eat a lot of salt.
And that's why certain Native American tribes didn't even know what salt was.
That's right. The ones that were hunter-gatherers, but the ones that were in agriculture sure did. And it was always, I mean, this is a thing that is found throughout history in every continent, that the group that controls the salt trade is the dominant group. You know, as were Mayans and Aztecs and, you know, Chinese and Phoenicians and Egyptians. And you can go everywhere in the world and find that the salt traders were the power.
I think anyone who reads this book, Salt, will quickly figure out that there's a very strong connection between salt and some of your other work, including the book Cod and the book The Basque History of the World. Now, which came first? How did you decide what order to proceed in? And how did you get the idea to write these books?
Well, they all came about kind of differently, I didn't actually write them in the order that they came to me. If I had, the Basque book would have been first. I for a very long time wanted to write a book about Basques, and have been spending a lot of time with Basques since Franco times, since the early 1970s. Mm. And was always a little worried that nobody cared about the Basque. It would be very hard to sell this book. Frankly, didn't really have the nerve to suggest it to anyone. And then both I and my publisher, George Gibson at Walker, noticed when I did the Cod book that some of the most popular parts of the book were the parts about the Basques.
Oh.
So that gave me the courage to do this book on the Basque that I had always wanted to do. I did the Cod book because I just eventually realized that it was this great story, and that it had this. It was all about Atlantic nations and their entire history and what brought Europeans to North America, and so many things. And then it has this sad ending, which is the beginning of overfishing. And, you know, overfishing is one of these subjects that even as I say the word, you know, I fear half your listeners are turning their dial. you don't have dials anymore. But
oh, some of us do.
And I realized that here was a way to talk about overfishing, this very important and dull issue, in a way that was actually amusing and entertaining and a good story. And, you know, anytime you can breathe life into an important and seemingly dull issue, it's, you know, that's what writing is all about. Mm. So it was a great opportunity. And then I got the idea for Salt from Cod, because there was this time in history when fortunes were being made on salt cod and Europeans grabbing North American land were getting access to more and more fishing grounds and expanding their fisheries and making fortunes. And the only thing that was limiting the expansion was not being able to get enough salt. And so there was this dynamic in Europe of relations, treaties, and military alliances between salt-producing nations and fishing nations. And I realized the historic importance of salt. I had always wanted to do a food history book that had a kind of a broad sweep to it and showed how a food becomes a commodity of trade, and because of that, becomes important to economies, and because of that becomes part of politics and international relations, and eventually becomes part of the culture and even religion of countries. And I, through the Cod book, I realized that salt was the most spectacular example of this.
Mm. My guest is Mark Kurlansky. The book is Salt, A World History. As human beings, we have very short and very selective memories. In our last century, salt really has not been the source of power and money and prestige that it was through all the rest of time.
Right, for a number of reasons. One is that the thing that a number of things gave salt its importance, but the thing that was more important than anything else was the fact that salt was the only way that you could take a food and turn it into a commodity of trade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you were a dairy farmer and you produced butter and milk and cream, you could sell it to your neighbors, and that was about it. But if you cured it in salt and made a cheese, you could throw it on a wagon and sell it all over the world. And that was the only way before refrigeration that you could do this with food. I mean, same thing with meat, with fish, vegetables, sauerkraut, which is salt-cured cabbage, was an extremely important export product. And then a couple of things happened. One was that, you know, the Industrial Revolution, and not to mention, you know, technology and electronics, we now trade a lot of things besides food. You know, it used to be that food trading was what international trade was, but now we trade many other things, and food has sort of fallen down on the list. And, of course, the other thing is that we have refrigeration and freezing, so that you don't need salt to make a food a trade commodity. But the thing that really did salt in was that we started to get good at finding it.
Finally,
well, you know, man.
We've always been good, though, haven't we?
I'm sorry?
We've always been good at finding it. That's why it was so powerful.
Yes, yeah. But we got a lot better at finding it once we realized that it was associated with natural gas and oil. The age of petroleum began by drilling salt domes.
But they weren't looking for oil, were they?
Well, not originally. In fact, it was kind of a problem. Salt domes were considered a very good source of salt. Salt dome is a column of salt that can go miles into the earth, and it's very pure. And it pushes out in the earth's surface in a dome shape. It looks like a little hill.
Uh-huh.
And because of the purity of this salt, it was a great source. So people in the salt business looked for salt domes. But often, after exploiting them for a while, the salt started coming up kind of black and mucky, and it was hard to wash off. And it took a while to realize what the problem was.
Uh-huh.
But once they realized, there was just this fury to find salt domes. And, you know, anybody who found new salt formed an oil company immediately, and which sometimes worked and sometimes didn't. The technology of drilling advanced very rapidly in about 10 or 15 years. And for the first time in human history, we had a pretty good idea of what was under the surface of the earth. And it just turns out that there's salt everywhere, just huge, huge beds of it.
Uh-huh.
That many of the salt sources are completely connected. For instance, there's a very ancient history of salt in Alsace and salt in Germany and salt in Austria and salt in southern Poland. Turns out it's all the same salt, one huge bed. The entire Great Lakes area, you know, including upstate New York and Ontario and beyond Minnesota, is a huge bed of salt. And these beds of salt aren't even very deep in the ground. They're very easy to get at.
I love this kind of book because there is so much fascinating trivia and amazing information. The story of the I think it was the Chinese who discovered the natural gas along with the salt, and they made these gigantic bamboo networks to...
Yeah, fantastic.
That was totally bizarre.
Fantastic. The first known case of natural gas being used in the world in about 200 A.D., after centuries of thinking that dragons were under the earth guarding the salt, and because there would be these explosions and workers would get sick and there'd be sudden bursts of flame. And finally they started to realize that there was this invisible substance and that you could just put a pipe below the well, the same wellhead that you were taking brine out of the earth, and it would travel. If you just made the boiling house higher up than the wellhead, it would just travel up the pipe and you could light it and use it for boiling the brine. I often wonder who they got to light the first pipe, and did they know to make it a small valve?
Yeah. I'm sure they learned by trial and error.
Right.
The Chinese are fascinating because they seem to be so patient. You have these guys sitting there drilling.
Yeah. Yeah, and on these seesaw things with a chisel on the end and pounding on rock up and down, and drilling hundreds and hundreds of feet through rock, which is a feat that, you know, the West never accomplished until the petroleum age.
Uh-huh. My guest is Mark Kurlansky. The book Salt, World History has just come out in paperback, published by Penguin. He joins us in the Book Nook today. Early in the book, you talk about these miners going into salt mines and discovering some of their forebears, very well preserved.
Yeah, the Celts. The Celts were an example of a people who ruled most of Western Europe and largely did this through the control of salt that they mined in Central Europe and then traded around Europe and very quickly realized that a smarter idea than trading salt was trading salted products like hams. Built this huge empire, which then disappeared after being defeated by Julius Caesar. Many centuries later, in the shafts of salt mines in Austria, started finding these Celtic miners, just preserved like a... To use the words of the people who found them, preserved like a codfish.
Just sitting there in these brightly colored clothes.
Yeah, the textiles were also preserved, and they were brilliant. Yeah, brilliant twill, sort of like Scottish clan plaids today.
I didn't realize it, but now I know, having read this book, that salt really is responsible for pretty much everything in our history.
Yes.
Well,
it is very much involved with most wars, because you couldn't have an army without salt. Because you needed salted provisions. If you had horses or cattle, they had to be fed enormous amounts of salt, and salt was also used for healing wounds. So it was always a strategy to try to deprive your enemy of salt, which the British succeeded doing to the Americans in the Revolution, and the Union did to the Confederacy, and the Russians did to Napoleon. And it was always a strategy.
I was amazed by the salt component in the French Revolution.
Yeah, this is very much the history of France, which is why the French are among the few people who don't think I'm crazy for writing a book about salt. Mm. To French people, this makes perfect sense. They study salt history in school.
Well, they had the best salt, too.
Well, that's French marketing, which should never be underestimated. But France was put together from various duchies and dukedoms and smaller states that were acquired. And as each part was acquired, in the Treaty of Acquisition, the French crown would make some sort of arrangement on salt taxation. And the result was that when France was fully formed, there was a huge variation in the price from one part of France to another. So you had, for example, the Bretons, in their agreement to join France, the crown agreed not to tax their salt at all. So they had tax-free salt. And on the other side of the Loire River was an area that had the highest tax in France. And there was an enormous difference between the price. And so smuggling salt across the Loire, which is not a terribly wide or difficult river, was a huge business. And there were also many really difficult, painful laws about requiring every citizen to buy a certain amount of salt. And you couldn't even use this salt for preserving things, for making your hams or your cheese. This had to be used as table salt, and the amount you were required per person was far more than anybody could use. And people started rebelling against these things. The French created a special paramilitary force just to enforce salt law. There were thousands and thousands of people in prison for crimes against the salt administration, and it just became this thing that people hated. And it was one of the major issues of the French Revolution.
And Marie Antoinette loved her, choucroute?
Choucroute, yes.
What is that?
Which is sauerkraut with... it's had an interesting evolution, but it's always been sauerkraut with different salted things in it. At some points it was salted fish. At other points it was hams and sausage. There were even recipes for sauerkraut and caviar, but it was always, salted cabbage with some salted food. Yeah, and she loved it, and she got her whole household and her guards and everybody into eating choucroute. And that's why today in Paris, the areas that are around the royalist areas are the places that have the cafes that serve these big choucroute lunches. I'll tell you what my favorite piece of minutiae is.
Okay.
It's funny. I recently had the privilege of interviewing Walter Cronkite.
Oh, really?
And he said something remarkable about me. He said, why you're the leading expander of minutia, which I thought was great.
He's familiar with your work.
So it seemed, yeah.
Now, why were you interviewing him?
I was interviewing him because I'm working on a book about the year 1968.
Oh, that's quite a year.
Yes, and I'm...
A lot of assassinations, a lot of unrest.
A lot of anti-authoritarian protest movements all over the world, and I'm trying to understand it from a global perspective and why, because the issues were very different in different countries, but why they all did these very similar things. One of the components in that answer is the changes in television coverage, which is why I was talking to Walter Cronkite.
And the Vietnam War in particular?
A huge factor. People all over the world were extremely angry about it and were getting very firsthand information on it. And that certainly was one of the global factors.
Well, according to Richard Reeves in his book, Nixon in the White House, he said that when Nixon was running for president in 1968, he would tell people to zoom in on the anti-war protesters, to zoom in on the activists screaming things, and that's what he wanted shown on television.
To promote this idea that we were on the edge of anarchy and only he could save us.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I never realized he did. I think it's very clever.
Yeah, it was an age where people were first learning all sorts of little media tricks that are common knowledge now.
Was it difficult to get an interview with Cronkite?
He was tremendously gracious. It was a matter of scheduling. You can imagine what his schedule is like. He's also a man who... is enjoying life and is supposed to be retired, but extremely busy.
I know he likes to go. I think he has a boat he likes to take out, doesn't he?
He sold it.
Oh, did he?
That was the first thing he told me. He was not very happy about this decision.
Yeah, we actually had his daughter on this program a number of years ago. She had a book out. I think it was about depression. I'm trying to remember. Kathy Cronkite. Who's the one person that you wish you could interview for this book you're working on who isn't available?
For the 68 book?
Yeah. Henry Kissinger. No, I'm just kidding.
Mario Sevilla.
Oh, okay.
Who, unfortunately, is no longer with us. But
the man from Berkeley?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, 64, the free speech movement, which was the inspiration for... college campus movements all over the world, and was a very, very unusual and forceful presence who, in fact, gave probably the only great speech that was ever given by a 60s radical on campus.
Well, Mark, we've opened up Pandora's box, but I need...
On that note, let's all go home.
I need to close the salt cellar right now. We're out of granules. My guest has been Mark Kurlansky. The book is Salt, A World History. You've been listening to Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. Hold the phone, Mark. That was Mark Kurlansky, recorded back in 2003, talking about his book Salt, A World History. And there's been a lot of salt on the road this week. We had our first measurable snowfall. Let's listen to a song to welcome winter. This is the late Bill Morrissey, recorded on this program back in 1996.
This is another winter song. They sat at each end of the couch, watched as the fire burned down so quiet. On this winter night, not a house light on for miles around. And he said, I think I'll fill the stove. It's getting time for bed. She looked up, I think I'll have some wine. How about you, she asked. And he declined. And Warren, she said, maybe just for tonight. let's fill the stove with birches. Watch as the fire burns bright, how long has it been? I know it's quite a while, pour yourself half a glass. Stay with me a little while. Warren, he shook his head, as if she'd made some kind of joke. Birches on a winter night, no, we'll fill the stove with oak. Oak will burn as long and hot as a July afternoon. And birch will burn itself out by the rising of the moon. And you hate a cold house, same as me. Am I right or not? All right, that's true, she said. It was just a thought that she said, Warren, you do look tired. Maybe you should go up to bed. I'll take care of the wood tonight. Oak, he told her. Oak, she said. Well, she listened to his footsteps as he climbed up the stairs. As she pulled a sweater on her and set her wine glass on a chair, she walked down the cellar to the wood box. It was as cold as an ice chest. Then climbed back up with four logs, each as white as a wedding dress. And she filled the stove and poured the wine. Then she sat down on the floor and she curled her legs beneath her as the fire sprang to life once more. And it filled the room with its hungry light, and it cracked as it drew air, and the shadows danced a jittery waltz like no one else was there. As she stood up in the heat, as she twirled around the room, and the shadows, they saw nothing but a young girl on her honeymoon. And she knew the time, it would be short, soon a fire would start to fade. She thought of heat, she thought of time, and she called it an even trade.
Bill Morrissey. Bill, every time I hear that song, no matter how many times I hear it, it gives me chills. I mean, it's such a sentimental, emotional song. How do you write songs like that?
Well, that one took 9 years. From I was hauling wood up in Maine at a friend's house, and I was living in New Hampshire at the time, and heating with wood. And when you heat with wood, you learn the properties of the different types. And I just happened to have four birch logs that were very brilliant white, and the image of four birch logs as white as a wedding dress came to me. And I knew there was a song there, but I, for the life of me, couldn't do anything with it. I worked on it for 2 years and put it away. I just was a little frustrated. And then when I was writing the songs for Night Train, I remembered that. And it just kind of popped out in 45 minutes, but that was like 9 years after the original idea.
That was the late Bill Morrissey playing his song Birches in studio, recorded back in 1996. And I miss him. That's my favorite song by Bill Morrissey. You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, your home for independent news and handpicked music. I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. Stay tuned. More great radio coming up.